confusing about cloning factor 8. As with the cloning of insulin, the effort had evolved into a race, although with different competitors. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, a team of researchers from Harvard, led by Tom Maniatis and Mark Potashny, were also racing toward the factor 8 gene, having formed their own company named the Genetics Institute, colloquially called GI. The Factor 8 project, both teams knew, would challenge the outer limits of gene cloning technology. Somatostatin had 14 amino acids. Insulin had 51. Factor 8 had 2,350. The leap in size between somatostatin and Factor 8 was 160-fold, almost equivalent to the jump in distance between Wilbur Wright's first airborne circle at Kitty Hawk and Lindbergh's journey across the Atlantic. The leap in size was not just a quantitative barrier. To succeed, the gene cloners would need to use new cloning technologies. Both the somatostatin and insulin genes had been created from scratch by stitching together bases of DNA. A added chemically to the G and the C, and so forth. But the factor 8 gene was far too large to be created using DNA chemistry. To isolate the factor 8 gene, both Genentech and GI would need to pull the native gene out of human cells, spooling it out as if extracting a worm from the soil. But the worm would not come out easily, or intact, from the genome. Most genes in the human genome are, recall, interrupted by stretches of DNA called introns, which are like garbled stuffers placed in between parts of a message. Rather than the word genome, the actual gene reads gen, dot, 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 ohm, dot, 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 e. The introns in human genes are often enormous, stretching across vast lengths of DNA, making it virtually impossible to clone a gene directly. The intron-containing gene is too long to fit into a bacterial plasmid. Maniatis found an ingenious solution. He had pioneered the technology to build genes out of RNA templates using reverse transcriptase, the enzyme that could build DNA from RNA. The use of reverse transcriptase made gene cloning vastly more efficient. Reverse transcriptase made it possible to clone a gene after the intervening stuffer sequences had been snipped off by the cell's splicing apparatus. The cell would do all the work. Even long, unwieldy intron-interrupted genes such as factor 8 would be processed by the cell's gene splicing apparatus and could thus be cloned from cells. By the late summer of 1983, using all the available technologies, both teams had managed to clone the factor 8 gene. It was now a furious race to the finish. In December 1983, still running shoulder to shoulder, both groups announced that they had assembled the entire sequence and inserted the gene into a plasmid. The plasmid was then introduced into hamster-derived ovary cells, known for their ability to synthesize vast quantities of proteins. In January 1984, the first cargoes of factor 8 began to appear in the tissue culture fluid. In April, exactly 2 years after the first AIDS clusters had been reported in America, both Genentech and GI announced that they had purified recombinant factor 8 in test tubes, a blood-clotting factor untainted by human blood. In March 1987, Gilbert White, a hematologist, conducted the first clinical trial of the hamster cell-derived recombinant factor 8 at the Center for Thrombosis in North Carolina. The first patient to be treated was GM, a 43-year-old man with hemophilia. As the initial drops of intravenous liquid dripped into his veins, White hovered anxiously around GM's bed, trying to anticipate reactions to the drug. A few minutes into the transfusion, GM stopped speaking. His eyes were closed. His chin rested on his chest. "Talk to me," White urged. There was no response. White was about to issue a medical alert when GM turned around, made the sound of a hamster, and burst into laughter. News of GM's successful treatment spread through a desperate community of hemophiliacs. AIDS among hemophiliacs had been a cataclysm within a cataclysm. Unlike gay men who had quickly organized a concerted, defiant response to the epidemic, boycotting bathhouses and clubs, advocating safe sex and campaigning for condoms, hemophiliacs had watched the shadow of the illness advance with numb horror. They could hardly boycott blood. Between April 1984 and March 1985, until the first test for virally contaminated blood was released by the FDA, Every hemophiliac patient admitted to a hospital faced the terrifying choice of bleeding to death or becoming infected with a fatal virus. The infection rate among hemophiliacs during this period was staggering. Among those with the severe variant of the disease, 90% would acquire HIV through contaminated blood. Recombinant factor 8 arrived too late to save the lives of most of these men and women. Nearly all the HIV-infected hemophiliacs from the initial cohort would die of the complications of AIDS. Even so, the production of factor 8 from its gene broke important conceptual ground, although it was tinged with peculiar irony. The fears of Asilomar had been perfectly inverted. In the end, a natural pathogen had unleashed havoc on human populations, and the strange artifice of gene cloning, inserting human genes into bacteria and then manufacturing proteins in hamster cells, had emerged as potentially the safest way to produce a medical product for human use. It's tempting to write the history of technology through products, the wheel, the microscope, the airplane, the internet, but it is more illuminating to write the history of technology through transitions, linear motion to circular motion, visual space to subvisual space, motion on land to motion in air, physical connectivity to virtual connectivity. The production of proteins from recombinant DNA represented one such crucial transition in the history of medical technology. To understand the impact of this transition from gene to medicine, we need to understand the history of medicinal chemicals. Stripped to its bare essence, a medicinal chemical, a drug, is nothing more than a molecule that enables a therapeutic change in human physiology. Medicines can be simple chemicals. Water, in the right context and at the right dose, is a potent drug, or they can be complex, multidimensional, many-faced molecules. They are also astoundingly rare. Although there are seemingly thousands of drugs in human usage, aspirin alone comes in dozens of variants, the number of molecular reactions targeted by these drugs is a minuscule fraction of the total number of reactions. Of the several million variants of biological molecules in the human body, enzymes, receptors, hormones, and so forth, only about 250, 0.025%, are therapeutically modulated by our current pharmacopoeia. If human physiology is visualized as a vast global telephone network with interacting nodes and networks, then our current medicinal chemistry touches only a fraction of a fraction of its complexity. Medicinal chemistry is a pole operator in Wichita tinkering with a few lines in the network's corner. The paucity of medicines has one principal reason, specificity. Nearly every drug works by binding to its target and enabling or disabling it, turning molecular switches on or off. To be useful, a drug must bind to its switches, but to only a selected set of switches. An indiscriminate drug is no different from a poison. Most molecules can barely achieve this level of discrimination, but proteins have been designed explicitly for this purpose. Proteins, recall, are the hubs of the biological world. They are the enablers and the disablers, the machinators, the regulators, the gatekeepers, the operators of cellular reactions. They are the switches that most drugs seek to turn on and off. Proteins are thus poised to be some of the most potent and most discriminating medicines in the pharmacological world. But to make a protein, one needs its gene, and here, recombinant DNA technology provided the crucial missing stepping stone. The cloning of human genes allowed scientists to manufacture proteins, and the synthesis of proteins opened the possibility of targeting the millions of biochemical reactions in the human body. Proteins made it possible for chemists to intervene on previously impenetrable aspects of our physiology. The use of recombinant DNA to produce proteins thus marked a transition not just between one gene and one medicine, but between genes and a novel universe of drugs. On October 14, 1980, Genentech sold 1 million of its shares to the public, provocatively listing itself at the stock exchange under the trading symbol GENE. This initial sale would rank among the most dazzling debuts of any technology company in Wall Street history. Within a few hours, the company had generated $35 million in capital. By then, the pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly had acquired the license to produce and sell recombinant insulin, called Humulin, to distinguish it from cow and pig insulin, and was rapidly expanding its market. Sales rose from $8 million in 1983 to $90 million in 1996 to $700 million in 1998. Swanson, a short, chunky, chipmunk-cheeked 36-year-old, as Esquire magazine described him, was now a millionaire several times over, as was Boyer. A graduate student who had held on to a few throwaway shares for helping to clone the somatostatin gene over the summer of 1977, woke up one morning and found himself a newly minted multimillionaire. In 1982, Genentech began to produce human growth hormone, HGH, used to treat certain variants of dwarfism. In 1986, biologists at the company cloned alpha interferon, a potent immunological protein used to treat blood cancers. In 1987, Genentech made recombinant TPA, a blood thinner to dissolve the clots that occur during a stroke or a heart attack. In 1990, it launched efforts to create vaccines out of recombinant genes, beginning with a vaccine against hepatitis B. In December 1990, Roche Pharmaceuticals acquired a majority stake in Genentech for $2.1 billion. Swanson stepped down as the chief executive. Boyer left his position as vice president in 1991. In the summer of 2001, Genentech launched its physical expansion into the largest biotech research complex in the world, a multi-acre stretch of glass-wrapped buildings, rolling greens, and frisbee-playing research students that is virtually indistinguishable from any university campus. At the center of the vast complex sits a modest bronze statue of a man in a suit gesticulating over a table to a scientist in flared jeans and a leather vest. The man is leaning forward. The geneticist looks puzzled and is gazing distantly over the man's shoulder. Swanson, unfortunately, was not present for the formal unveiling of the statue, commemorating his first meeting with Boyer. In 1999, at age 52, he was diagnosed with glioblastoma multiforme, a brain tumor. He died on December 6, 1999, at home in Hillsboro, a few miles from Genentech's campus. Part 4. The Proper Study of Mankind is Man. Human Genetics, 1970 to 2005. Know then thyself, presume not God to scan. The proper study of mankind is man. Alexander Pope, Essay on Man. How beauteous mankind is, O brave new world that has such people in it. William Shakespeare, The Tempest, Act 5, Scene 1. The Miseries of My Father. Albany. How have you known the miseries of your father? Edgar. By nursing them, my lord. William Shakespeare, King Lear, Act 5, Scene 3. In the spring of 2014, my father had a fall. He was sitting on his favorite rocking chair, a hideous, off-kilter contraption that he had commissioned from a local carpenter, when he tipped over the back and fell off. The carpenter had devised a mechanism to make the chair rock, but had forgotten to add a mechanism to stop the chair from rocking over. My mother found him face down on the veranda, his hand tucked under his body unnaturally like a snapped wing. His right shoulder was bathed in blood. She couldn't pull his shirt over his head, so she took a pair of scissors to it, while he screamed in pain from his wound and in deeper agony at having a perfectly intact piece of clothing ripped to shreds before his eyes. You could have tried to save it, he later groused as they drove to the emergency room. It was an ancient quarrel. His mother, who had never had five shirts for all five boys at a time, would have found a way to rescue it. You could take a man out of partition, but you could not take partition out of the man. He had gashed the skin on his forehead and broken his right shoulder. He was, like me, a terrible patient, impulsive, suspicious, reckless, anxious about confinement, and deluded about his recovery. I flew to India to see him. By the time I arrived home from the airport, it was late at night. He was lying in bed, looking vacantly at the ceiling. He seemed to have aged. Suddenly, I asked him if he knew what day it was. April 24th, he said correctly. And the year? 1946, he said, then corrected himself, groping for the memory. 2006? It was a fugitive memory. I told him it was 2014. 1946, I noted privately, had been another season of catastrophe. the year that Rajesh had died. Over the next days, my mother nursed him back to health. His lucidity ebbed back, and some of his long-term memory returned, although his short-term memory was still significantly impaired. We determined that the rocking chair accident was not as simple as it had sounded. He had not tipped backward, but had attempted to get up from the chair, then lost his balance and shot forward, unable to catch himself. I asked him to walk across the room and noticed that his gait had an ever so slight shuffle. There was something robotic and constrained in his movements, as if his feet were made of iron and the floor had turned magnetic. "Turn around quickly," I said, and he almost fell forward again. Late that night, another indignity occurred. He wet his bed. I found him in the bathroom, bewildered and ashamed, clutching his underwear. In the Bible, Ham's descendants are cursed because he stumbles on his father, Noah, drunken and naked, his genitals exposed, lying in a field in the half-light of dawn. In the modern version of that story, you encounter your father, demented and naked, in the half-light of the guest bathroom, and see the curse of your own future, illuminated. The urinary incontinence, I learned, had been occurring for a while. It had begun with the feeling of urgency, the inability to hold back once the bladder was half full, and progressed to bedwetting. He had told his doctors about it, and they had waved it off, vaguely attributing it to a swollen prostate. "It's all old age," they had told him. He was 82. Old men fall, they lose their memory, they wet their beds. The unifying diagnosis came to us in a flash of shame the next week when he had an MRI of his brain. The ventricles of the brain, which bathed the brain in fluid, were swollen and dilated, and the tissue of the brain had been pushed out to the edges. The condition is called normal pressure hydrocephalus, NPH. It is thought to result from the abnormal flow of fluid around the brain, causing a buildup in the ventricles, somewhat akin to the hypertension of the brain, the neurologist explained. NPH is characterized by an inexplicable classic triad of symptoms: gait instability, urinary incontinence, dementia. My father had not fallen by accident. He had fallen ill. Over the next few months, I learned everything I could about the condition. The illness has no known cause. It runs in families. One variant of the illness is genetically linked to the X chromosome with a disproportionate predominance for men. In some families, it occurs in men as young as 20 or 30. In other families, only the elderly are affected. In some, the pattern of inheritance is strong. In others, only occasional members have the illness. The youngest documented familial cases are in children 4 or 5 years old. The oldest patients are in their 70s and 80s. It is, in short, quite likely to be a genetic disease, although not genetic in the same sense as sickle cell anemia or hemophilia. No single gene governs the susceptibility to this bizarre illness. Multiple genes spread across multiple chromosomes specify the formation of the aqueducts of the brain during development, just as multiple genes spread across multiple chromosomes specify the formation of the wing in a fruit fly. Some of these genes, I learned, govern the anatomical configurations of the ducts and vessels of the ventricles. As an analog, consider how pattern formation genes can specify organs and structures in flies. Others encode the molecular channels that transmit fluids between the compartments. Yet other genes encode proteins that regulate the absorption of fluids from the brain into the blood, or vice versa. And since the brain and its ducts grow in the fixed cavity of the skull, genes that determine the size and shape of the skull also indirectly affect the proportions of the channels and the ducts. Variations in any of these genes may alter the physiology of the aqueducts and ventricles, changing the manner in which fluid moves through the channels. Environmental influences such as aging or cerebral trauma interpose further layers of complexity. There is no one-to-one mapping of one gene and one illness. Even if you inherit the entire set of genes that causes NPH in one person, you may still need an accident or an environmental trigger to release it. In my father's case, the trigger was most likely his age. If you inherit a particular combination of genes, say those that specify a particular rate of fluid absorption, with those that specify a particular size of the aqueducts, you might have an increased risk of succumbing to the illness. It is a Delphic boat of a disease, determined not by one gene, but by the relationship between genes and between genes and the environment. How does an organism transmit the information needed to create form and function to its embryo? Aristotle had asked. The answer to that question viewed through model organisms such as peas, fruit flies, and bread molds, had launched the discipline of modern genetics. It had resulted ultimately in that monumentally influential diagram that forms the basis of our understanding of information flow in living systems. A gene encodes a message to build a protein to enable form function that regulates a gene encodes a message to build a protein and so on. But my father's illness offers yet another lens by which we might view how hereditary information influences the form, function, and fate of an organism. Was my father's fall the consequence of his genes? Yes and no. His genes created a propensity for an outcome rather than the outcome itself. Was it a product of his environment? Yes and no. It was the chair, after all, that had done it, but he had sat on that same chair without a vent for the good part of a decade before an illness had tipped him, literally, over an edge. Was it a chance? Yes. Who knew that certain pieces of furniture moved at certain angles are designed to jettison you forward? Was it an accident? Yes. But his physical instability virtually guaranteed a fall. The challenge of genetics as it moved from simple organisms to the human organism was to confront new ways to think about the nature of heredity, information flow, function, and fate. How do genes intersect with environments to cause normalcy versus disease? For that matter, what is normalcy versus disease? How do the variations in genes cause variations in human form and function? How do multiple genes influence a single outcome? How can there be so much uniformity among humans, yet such diversity? How can the variants in genes sustain a common physiology, yet also produce unique pathologies? The birth of a clinic. In 1962, a few months after the DNA triplet code had been deciphered by Nirenberg and his colleagues in Bethesda, the New York Times published an article about the explosive future of human genetics. Now that the code had been cracked, the Times projected, human genes would become malleable to intervention. It is safe to say that some of the biological bombs that are likely to explode before long as a result of breaking the genetic code will rival even the atomic variety in their meaning for man. Some of them might be determining the basis of thought, developing remedies for afflictions that today are incurable, such as cancer and many of the tragic inherited disorders. Skeptics might, however, have been forgiven for their lack of enthusiasm. The biological bomb of human genetics had, thus far, burst forth with a rather underwhelming whimper. The astonishing growth spurt of molecular genetics between 1943 and 1962, from Avery's experiment to the solution of the structure of DNA and the mechanisms of gene regulation and repair, had produced a progressively detailed mechanistic vision of the gene, yet the gene had barely touched the human world. On one hand, the Nazi eugenicists had so definitively scorched the earth of human genetics that the discipline had been leached of scientific legitimacy and rigor. On the other, simpler model systems, bacteria, flies, worms, had proved to be vastly more tractable to experimental studies than humans. When Thomas Morgan traveled to Stockholm to collect the Nobel Prize for his contributions to genetics in 1934, he was pointedly dismissive about the medical relevance of his work. "The most important contribution to medicine that genetics has made is, in my opinion, intellectual," Morgan wrote. The word intellectual was not meant as a compliment, but as an insult. Genetics, Morgan noted, was unlikely to have even a marginal impact on human health in the near future. The notion that a doctor may then want to call in his genetic friends for consultation, as Morgan put it, seemed like a silly, far-fetched fantasy. Yet the entry, or rather re-entry, of genetics into the human world was the product of medical necessity. In 1947, Victor McCusick, a young internist at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, saw a teenage patient with spots on his lips and tongue and multiple internal polyps. McCusick was intrigued by the symptoms. Other members of the family were also afflicted by similar symptoms, and familial cases with similar features had been published in the literature. McCusick described the case in the New England Journal of Medicine, arguing that the cluster of seemingly diffuse symptoms, tongue spots, polyps, bowel obstruction, and cancer, were all the product of a mutation in a single gene. McCusick's case, later classified as Peutz-Jeghers syndrome, after the first clinicians who described it, launched his lifelong interest in the study of the links between genetics and human diseases. He began by studying human diseases in which the influence of genes was the simplest and strongest, where one gene was known to cause one disease. The best established examples of such illnesses in humans, though few, were unforgettable. Hemophilia among the English royals and sickle cell anemia in African and Caribbean families. By digging through old papers from the medical libraries at Hopkins, McCusick discovered that a London doctor working in the early 1900s had reported the first example of a human disease apparently caused by a single genetic mutation. In 1899, Archibald Garrod, an English pathologist, had described a bizarre illness that ran in families and became manifest within days of childbirth. Garrod had first observed it in a child at the sick hospital in London. Several hours after the boy had been born, his diaper linens had turned black with a peculiar stain of urine. By meticulously tracking down all such afflicted patients and their relatives, Garrod discovered that the disease ran in families and persisted through adulthood. In adults, sweat darkened spontaneously, sending rivulets of deep brown stains under the arms of shirts. Earwax even turned red as it touched the air, as if it had rusted on contact. Garrod guessed that some inherited factor had been altered in these patients. The boy with the dark urine, Garrod reasoned, must have been born with an alteration in a unit of inheritance that had changed some metabolic function in cells, resulting in a difference in the composition of urine. The phenomena of obesity and the various tints of hair, skin, and eyes can all be explained by variations in units of inheritance causing chemical diversities in human bodies, Garrod wrote. The prescience was remarkable. Even as the concept of the gene was being rediscovered by Bateson in England, and nearly a decade before the word gene had been coined, Garrod had conceptually visualized a human gene and explained human variation as chemical diversities encoded by units of inheritance. Genes make us human, Garrod had reasoned, and mutations make us different. Inspired by Garrod's work, McCusick launched a systematic effort to create a catalog of genetic diseases in humans, an encyclopedia of phenotypes, genetic traits, and disorders. An exotic cosmos opened up before him. The range of human diseases governed by individual genes was vaster and stranger than he had expected. In Marfan syndrome, originally described by a French pediatrician in the 1890s, a gene controlling the structural integrity of the skeleton and blood vessels was mutated. Patients grew unusually tall, with elongated arms and fingers, and had a propensity to die of sudden ruptures of the aorta or the heart's valves. For decades, some medical historians have asserted that Abraham Lincoln had an undiagnosed variant of the syndrome. Other families were afflicted by osteogenesis imperfecta, a disease caused by a mutation in a gene for collagen, a protein that forms and strengthens bone. Children with this disease were born with brittle bones that, like dry plaster, could crumble at the slightest provocation. They might fracture their legs spontaneously or awake one morning with dozens of broken ribs. Often mistaken for child abuse, the cases were brought to medical attention after police investigations. In 1957, McCusick founded the Moore Clinic at Johns Hopkins, named after Joseph Earl Moore, the Baltimore physician who had spent his life working on chronic illnesses. The clinic would focus on hereditary disorders. McCusick turned into a walking repository of knowledge of genetic syndromes. There were patients unable to process chloride who were afflicted by intractable diarrhea and malnourishment. There were men prone to heart attacks at 20, families with schizophrenia, depression, or aggression, children born with webbed necks or extra fingers or the permanent odor of fish. By the mid-1980s, McCusick and his students had cataloged 2,239 genes linked with diseases in humans and 3,700 diseases linked to single genetic mutations. By the 12th edition of his book, published in 1998, McCusick had discovered an astounding 12,000 gene variants linked to traits and disorders, some mild and some life-threatening. Emboldened by their taxonomy of single-gene monogenic diseases, McCusick and his students ventured into diseases caused by the convergent influence of multiple genes, polygenic syndromes. Polygenic diseases, they found, came in two forms: Some were caused by the presence of whole extra chromosomes. In Down syndrome, first described in the 1860s, children are born with an extra copy of chromosome 21, which has 300 odd genes strung on it. Multiple organs are affected by the extra copy of the chromosome. Men and women with the syndrome are born with flattened nasal bridges, wide faces, small chins, and altered folds in the eyes. They have cognitive deficits, accelerated heart disease, hearing loss, infertility, and an increased risk for blood cancers. Many children die in infancy or childhood, and only a few survive to late adulthood. Most notably, perhaps, children with Down syndrome have an extraordinary sweetness of temperament, as if in inheriting an extra chromosome, they had acquired a concomitant loss of cruelty and malice. If there is any doubt that genotypes can influence temperament or personality, then a single encounter with a Down child can lay that idea to rest. The final category of genetic diseases that McCusick categorized was the most complex. Polygenic illnesses caused by multiple genes scattered diffusely throughout the genome. Unlike the first two categories, populated by rare and strange syndromes, these were familiar, pervasive, highly prevalent chronic illnesses: diabetes, coronary artery disease, hypertension, schizophrenia, depression, infertility, obesity. These illnesses lay on the opposite end of the one gene, one disease paradigm. They were many genes, many diseases. Hypertension, for instance, came in thousands of varieties and was under the influence of hundreds of genes, each exerting a minor additive effect on blood pressure and vascular integrity. Unlike Marfan or Down syndrome, where a single potent mutation or a chromosomal aberration was necessary and sufficient to cause the disease, the effect of any individual gene in polygenic syndromes was dulled. The dependence on environmental variables, diet, age, smoking, nutrition, prenatal exposures, was stronger. The phenotypes were variable and continuous, and the patterns of inheritance complex. The genetic component of the disease only acted as one trigger in a many-triggered gun, necessary but not sufficient to cause the illness. Four important ideas emerge from McCusick's taxonomy of genetic diseases. First, McCusick realized that mutations in a single gene can cause diverse manifestations of disease in diverse organs. In Marfan syndrome, for instance, a mutation in a fiber-like structural protein affects all connective tissues, tendons, cartilage, bones, and ligaments. Marfan patients have recognizably abnormal joints and spines. Less recognizable, perhaps, are the cardiovascular manifestations of Marfan disease. The same structural protein that supports tendons and cartilage also supports the large arteries and valves of the heart. Mutations in that gene thus lead to the catastrophic heart failures and aortic ruptures. Patients with Marfan syndrome often die in their youth because their blood vessels have been ruptured by the flow of blood. Second, the precise converse, surprisingly, was also true. Multiple genes could influence a single aspect of physiology. Blood pressure, for instance, is regulated through a variety of genetic circuits, and abnormalities in one or many of these circuits all result in the same disease, hypertension. It is perfectly accurate to say hypertension is a genetic disease, but to also add, there is no gene for hypertension. Many genes tug and push the pressure of blood in the body like a tangle of strings controlling a puppet's arms. If you change the length of any of these individual strings, you change the configuration of the puppet. McCusick's third insight concerned the penetrance and expressivity of genes in human diseases. Fruit fly geneticists and worm biologists had discovered that certain genes only become actualized into phenotypes depending upon environmental triggers or random chance. A gene that causes facets to appear in the fruit fly eye, for instance, is temperature dependent. Another gene variant changes the morphology of a worm's intestine, but only does so in about 20% of worms. Incomplete penetrance meant that even if a mutation was present in the genome, its capacity to penetrate into a physical or morphological feature was not always complete. McCusick found several examples of incomplete penetrance in human diseases. For some disorders, such as Tay-Sachs disease, penetrance was largely complete. the inheritance of the gene mutation virtually guaranteed the development of the disease. But for other human diseases, the actual effect of a gene on the disorder was more complex. In breast cancer, as we shall later learn, inheritance of the mutant BRCA1 gene increases the risk of breast cancer dramatically. But not all women with the mutation will develop breast cancer, and different mutations in that gene have different levels of penetrance. Hemophilia, the bleeding disorder, is clearly the result of a genetic abnormality, but the extent to which a patient with hemophilia experiences bleeding episodes varies widely. Some have monthly life-threatening bleeds, while others rarely bleed at all. The fourth insight is so pivotal to this story that I have separated it from the others. Like the fly geneticist Theodosius Dobzhansky, McCusick understood that mutations are just variations. The statement sounds like a bland truism, but it conveys an essential and profound truth. A mutation, McCusick realized, is a statistical entity, not a pathological or moral one. A mutation doesn't imply disease, nor does it specify a gain or loss of function. In a formal sense, a mutation is defined only by its deviation from the norm. The opposite of mutant is not normal, but wild type, i.e. the type or variant found more commonly in the wild. A mutation is thus a statistical rather than a normative concept. A tall man parachuted into a nation of dwarfs is a mutant, as is a blonde child born in a country of brunettes. And both are mutants in precisely the same sense, that a boy with Marfan syndrome is a mutant among non-Marfan, i.e. normal children. By itself, then, a mutant or a mutation can provide no real information about a disease or disorder. The definition of disease rests rather on the specific disabilities caused by an incongruity between an individual's genetic endowment and his or her current environment, between a mutation, the circumstances of a person's existence, and his or her goals for survival or success. It is not mutation that ultimately causes disease, but mismatch. The mismatch can be severe and debilitating, and in such cases, the disease becomes identical to the disability. A child with the fiercest variant of autism who spends his days rocking monotonously in a corner, or scratching his skin into ulcers, possesses an unfortunate genetic endowment that is mismatched to nearly any environment or any goals. But another child with a different and rarer variant of autism may be functional in most situations and possibly hyperfunctional in some, a chess game, say, or a memory contest. His illness is situational. It lies more evidently in the incongruity of his specific genotype and his specific circumstances. Even the nature of the mismatch is mutable. Since the environment is constantly subject to change, the definition of disease has to change with it. In the land of the blind, the sighted man is king, but flood that land with a toxic blinding light, and the kingdom reverts to the blind. McCusick's belief in this paradigm, the focus on disability rather than abnormalcy, was actualized in the treatment of patients in his clinic. Patients with dwarfism, for instance, were treated by an interdisciplinary team of genetic counselors, neurologists, orthopedic surgeons, nurses, and psychiatrists trained to focus on specific disabilities of persons with short stature. Surgical interventions were reserved to correct specific deformities as they arose. The goal was not to restore normalcy, but vitality, joy, and function. McCusick had rediscovered the founding principles of modern genetics in the realm of human pathology. In humans, as in wild flies, genetic variations abounded. Here, too, genetic variants, environments, and gene-environment interactions ultimately collaborated to cause phenotypes, except in this case, the phenotype in question was disease. Here, too, some genes had partial penetrance and widely variable expressivity. One gene could cause many diseases, and one disease could be caused by many genes, and here too fitness could not be judged in absolutes. Rather, the lack of fitness, illness, in colloquial terms, was defined by the relative mismatch between an organism and environment. "The imperfect is our paradise," Wallace Stevens wrote. If the entry of genetics into the human world carried one immediate lesson, it was this. The imperfect was not just our paradise, it was also inextricably our mortal world. the degree of human genetic variation and the depth of its influence on human pathology was unexpected and surprising. The world was vast and various. Genetic diversity was our natural state, not just in isolated pockets and faraway places, but everywhere around us. Seemingly homogeneous populations were, in fact, strikingly heterogeneous. We had seen the mutants, and they were us. Nowhere, perhaps, was the increased visibility of mutants more evident than in that reliable barometer of American anxieties and fantasies, comic strips. In the early 1960s, human mutants burst ferociously into the world of comic characters. In November 1961, Marvel Comics introduced the Fantastic Four, a series about four astronauts who, trapped inside a rocket ship, like Herman Muller's fruit flies in bottles, are exposed to a shower of radiation and acquire mutations that bestow supernatural powers on them. The success of the Fantastic Four prompted the even more successful Spider-Man, the saga of young science whiz Peter Parker, who is bitten by a spider that has swallowed a fantastic amount of radioactivity. The spider's mutant genes are transmitted to Parker's body, presumably by horizontal transfer, a human version of Avery's transformation experiment, thus endowing Parker with the agility and proportionate strength of an arachnid. While Spider-Man and Fantastic Four introduced the mutant superhero to the American public, the X-Men, launched in September 1963, brought the mutant story to its psychological crescendo. Unlike its predecessors, X-Men's central plot concerned a conflict between mutants and normal humans. The normals had grown suspicious of the mutants, and the mutants, under fear of surveillance and the threat of mob violence, had retreated to a cloistered school for gifted youngsters designed to protect and rehabilitate them, a Moore clinic for comic book mutants. The most remarkable feature of X-Men was not its growing multifarious menagerie of mutant characters, a wolfman with steel claws or a woman able to summon English weather on command, but the reversed roles of the victim and the victimizer. In the typical comic book of the 50s, humans ran and hid from the terrifying tyranny of monsters. In X-Men, the mutants were forced to run and hide from the terrifying tyranny of normalcy. These concerns about imperfection, mutation, and normalcy leaped out of the pages of comic books into a 2-foot by 2-foot incubator in the spring of 1966. In Connecticut, two scientists working on the genetics of mental retardation, Mark Steele and Roy Bragg, aspirated a few milliliters of fluid containing fetal cells from the amniotic sac of a pregnant woman. They grew the fetal cells in a petri dish, stained the chromosomes, and then analyzed them under a microscope. None of these individual techniques was novel. Fetal cells from the amnion had first been examined to predict gender, XX versus XY chromosomes, in 1956. Amniotic fluid had safely been aspirated in the early 1890s, and the staining of chromosomes dated from Boveri's original work on sea urchins. But the advancing front of human genetics changed the stakes of these procedures. Bragg and Steele realized that well-established genetic syndromes, with evident chromosomal abnormalities, Down, Klinefelter, Turner, could be diagnosed in utero, and that pregnancy could voluntarily be terminated if fetal chromosomal abnormalities were detected. Two rather trivial and relatively safe medical procedures, amniocentesis and abortion, could thus be combined into a technology that would vastly exceed the sum of the individual parts. We know little of the first women to pass through the crucible of this procedure. What remains, in the barest sketches of case reports, are stories of young mothers faced with terrifying choices and their grief, bewilderment, and its reprieve. In April 1968, a 29-year-old woman, J.G., was seen at the New York Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn. Her family had been crisscrossed with a hereditary variant of Down syndrome. Her grandfather and her mother were both carriers. 6 years earlier, late in pregnancy, she had miscarried one child, a girl with Down syndrome. In the summer of 1963, a second girl was born, a healthy child. 2 years later, in the spring of 1965, she gave birth to another child, a boy. He was diagnosed with Down syndrome, mental retardation, and severe congenital abnormalities, including two open holes in his heart. The boy had lived for 5.5 months. Much of that brief life had been miserable. After a series of heroic surgical attempts to correct his congenital defects, He had died of heart failure in the intensive care unit. 5 months into her fourth pregnancy, with this haunted history in the backdrop, J.G. came to her obstetrician and requested prenatal testing. An unsuccessful amniocentesis was performed in early April. On April 29th, with the third trimester rapidly approaching, a second amniocentesis was attempted. This time, sheets of fetal cells grew out in the incubator. Chromosomal analysis revealed a male fetus with Down syndrome. On May 31st, 1968, on the very last week that abortion was still medically permissible, J.G. decided to terminate the pregnancy. The remains of the fetus were delivered on June 2nd. It bore the cardinal characteristics of Down syndrome. The mother withstood the procedure without complications, the case report states, and she was discharged home 2 days after. Nothing more is known about the mother or her family. The first therapeutic abortion, performed entirely on the basis of a genetic test, entered human history shrouded in secrecy, anguish, and grief. The floodgates of prenatal testing and abortion were thrown open in the summer of 1973 by an unexpected maelstrom of forces. In September 1969, Norma McCorvey, a 21-year-old carnival barker living in Texas, became pregnant with her third child. Penniless, often homeless and out of work, she sought an abortion to terminate the unwanted pregnancy, but was unable to find a clinic to perform the procedure legally, or for that matter, statutorily. The one place she found, she later revealed, was a closed clinic in an abandoned building, with dirty instruments scattered around the room and dried blood on the floor. In 1970, two attorneys brought her case against the state to a Texas court, arguing that McCorvey had a legal right to her abortion. The nominal defendant was Henry Wade, the Dallas district attorney. McCorvey had switched her name for the legal proceedings to a bland pseudonym, Jane Roe. The case, Roe v. Wade, moved through the Texas courts and climbed to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1970. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments for Roe v. Wade between 1971 and 1972. In January 1973, in a historic decision, the court ruled for McCorvey. Writing the majority opinion, Harry Blackmun, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, decreed that states could no longer outlaw abortions. A woman's right to privacy, Blackmun wrote, was broad enough to encompass her decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy. Yet a woman's right to privacy was not absolute. In an acrobatic attempt to counterbalance a pregnant woman's rights against the growing personhood of the fetus, the court found that the state could not limit abortions during the first trimester of pregnancy, but that as the fetus matured, its personhood became progressively protected by the state, and abortions could be restricted. The division of pregnancy into trimesters was a biologically arbitrary but legally necessary invention. As the legal scholar Alexander Bickel described it, the individual's, i.e. mother's, interest here overrides society's interest in the first 3 months, and subject only to health regulations, also in the second. In the third trimester, society is preeminent. The power unleashed by Roe reverberated swiftly through medicine. Roe may have handed reproductive control to women, but it had largely handed the control of the fetal genome to medicine. Before Roe, prenatal genetic testing had inhabited an uncertain limbo. Amniocentesis was permitted, but the precise legal stature of abortion was unknown. But with first and second trimester abortion legalized and the primacy of medical judgment acknowledged, genetic testing was poised to diffuse widely through clinics and hospitals around the nation. Human genes had become actionable. The effects of widespread testing and abortion were soon evident. In some states, the incidence of Down syndrome fell between 20% and 40% between 1971 and 1977. Among high-risk women in New York City, more pregnancies were terminated than carried to full term in 1978. By the mid-1970s, nearly 100 chromosomal disorders and 23 metabolic diseases were detectable by genetic testing in utero, including Turner and Klinefelter syndromes, Tay-Sachs, and Gaucher's disease. Tiny fault after tiny fault, medicine was sifting its way through the risk of several hundred known genetic diseases, one geneticist wrote. Genetic diagnosis, as one historian described it, became a medical industry. The selective abortion of affected fetuses had transformed into the primary intervention of genomic medicine. Invigorated by its capacity to intervene on human genes, genetic medicine entered a period of such headiness that it could even begin to rewrite its own past. In 1973, a few months after Roe v. Wade, McCusick published a new edition of his textbook on medical genetics. In a chapter on the prenatal detection of hereditary diseases, Joseph Dansis, the pediatrician, wrote, "In recent years, the feeling has grown among both physicians and the general public that we must be concerned not simply with ensuring the birth of a baby, but one who will not be a liability to society, to its parents, or to itself. The right to be born is being qualified by another right, to have a reasonable chance of a happy and useful life. This shift in attitude is shown by, among other things, the widespread movement for the reform or even the abolition of abortion law." Dansis had gently, but deftly, inverted history. The abortion movement, in Dansis's formulation, had not pushed the frontiers of human genetics forward by enabling doctors to terminate fetuses with genetic disorders. Rather, human genetics had pulled the reluctant cart of the abortion movement behind it, by shifting the attitude toward the treatment of devastating congenital diseases and thus softening the stance against abortion. In principle, Dansis continued, any illness with a sufficiently powerful genetic link could be intervened upon by prenatal testing and selective abortion. The right to be born could be rephrased as a right to be born with the right kind of genes. In June 1969, a woman named Hetty Park gave birth to a daughter with infantile polycystic kidney disease. Born with malformed kidneys, the child died 5 hours after birth. Devastated, Park and her husband sought the counsel of a Long Island obstetrician, Herbert Chesson. Assuming, incorrectly, that the child's disease was not genetic, in fact, infantile PKD, like cystic fibrosis, results from two copies of mutated genes inherited from the child's parents, Chesson reassured the parents and sent them home. In Chesson's opinion, the chance that Park and her husband would have another child born with the same illness was negligible, possibly nil. In 1970, following Chesson's counsel, the Parks conceived again and gave birth to another daughter. Unfortunately, Laura Park was also born with polycystic kidney disease. She suffered multiple hospitalizations and then died of complications of kidney failure at age 2.5. In 1979, as opinions such as Joseph Dansis's began to appear regularly in the medical and popular literature, the Parks sued Herbert Chesson, arguing that he had given them incorrect medical advice. Had the Parks known the true genetic susceptibilities of their child, they argued, they would have chosen not to conceive Laura. Their daughter was the victim of a flawed estimation of normalcy. Perhaps the most extraordinary feature of the case was the description of the harm. In traditional legal battles concerning medical error, the defendant, usually the physician, stood accused of the wrongful causation of death. The Parks argued that Chesson, their obstetrician, was guilty of the equal and opposite sin, the wrongful causation of life. In a landmark judgment, the court agreed with the Parks. Potential parents have a right to choose not to have a child when it can be reasonably established that the child would be deformed, the judge opined. One commentator noted, "The court asserted that the right of a child to be born free of genetic anomalies is a fundamental right." Interfere, interfere, interfere. After millennia in which most people have produced babies in happy ignorance of the risks they run, we may all have to start acting with the severe responsibility of genetic foresight. We never had to think about medicine like this before. Gerald Leach, Breeding Better People, 1970. No newborn should be declared human until it has passed certain tests regarding its genetic endowment. Francis Crick. Joseph Dansis was not just rewriting the past, he was also announcing the future. Even a casual reader of the extraordinary claim that every parent had to shoulder the duty to create babies who will not be a liability to society, or that the right to be born without genetic anomalies was a fundamental right, might have detected the cry of a rebirth within it. This was eugenics being reincarnated, if more politely, in the late half of the 20th century. Interfere, 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 Sidney Webb, the British eugenicist, had urged in 1910. A little more than six decades later, the legalization of abortion and the growing science of genetic analysis had provided the first formal framework for a novel kind of genetic interference on humans, a new form of eugenics. This, as its proponents were quick to point out, was not your Nazi grandfather's eugenics. Unlike American eugenics of the 1920s, or the more virulent European strain of the 1930s, there were no enforced sterilizations, no compulsory confinements, and no exterminations in gas chambers. Women were not sent away to isolation camps in Virginia. Ad hoc judges were not called in to classify men and women as imbeciles, morons, and idiots. Nor was chromosome number decided as a matter of personal taste. The genetic tests that formed the basis of fetal selection were, its proponents insisted, objective, standardized, and scientifically rigorous. The correlation between the test and the development of the subsequent medical syndrome was nearly absolute. All children born with an extra copy of chromosome 21, or a missing copy of the X chromosome, say, manifested at least some of the cardinal features of Down or Turner syndrome, respectively. Most important, prenatal testing and selective abortion were performed with no state mandate, no centralized directive, and with full freedom of choice. A woman could choose to be tested or not, choose to know the results or not, and choose to terminate or continue her pregnancy even after testing positive for a fetal abnormality. This was eugenics in its benevolent avatar. Its champions called it neo-eugenics, or nugenics. A crucial distinction between nugenics and old eugenics was the use of genes as units of selection. For Galton, for American eugenicists such as Priddy, and for Nazi eugenicists, the only mechanism to ensure genetic selection was through the selection of physical or mental attributes, i.e., through phenotypes. But these attributes are complex, and their link to genes cannot be simply captured. Intelligence, for instance, may have a genetic component, but it is much more evidently a consequence of genes' environments, gene-environment interactions, triggers, chance, and opportunities. Selecting intelligence, therefore, cannot guarantee that genes for intelligence will be selected, any more than selecting richness guarantees that a propensity for accumulating wealth will be selected. In contrast to Galton's and Priddy's method, the major advance of nugenics, its proponents insisted, was that scientists were no longer selecting phenotypes as surrogates for the underlying genetic determinants. Now, geneticists had the opportunity to select genes directly by examining the genetic composition of a fetus. To its many enthusiasts, neo-eugenics had shed the menacing guise of its past and emerged anew out of a scientific chrysalis. Its scope broadened even further in the mid-1970s. Prenatal testing and selective abortion had enabled a privatized form of negative eugenics, a means to select against certain genetic disorders. But coupled to this was the desire to instigate an equally expansive, laissez-faire form of positive eugenics, a means to select for favorable genetic attributes. As Robert Sensheimer, a geneticist, described it, "The old eugenics was limited to the numerical enhancement of the best of our existing gene pool. The new eugenics would in principle allow the conversion of all the unfit to the highest genetic level." In 1980, Robert Graham, a millionaire entrepreneur who had developed shatterproof sunglasses, endowed a sperm bank in California that would preserve sperm from men of the highest intellectual caliber to be accessed only to inseminate healthy, intelligent women. Called the Repository for Germinal Choice, the bank sought sperm from Nobel laureates across the world. The physicist William Shockley, the inventor of the silicon transistor, was among the few scientists who agreed to donate. Perhaps predictably, Graham ensured that his own sperm was added to the bank on the pretext that, although the committee in Stockholm was yet to recognize it, he was a future Nobel laureate, a genius in waiting. However ardent his fantasies, Graham's cryogenic utopia was not embraced by the public. Over the next decade, only 15 children would be born from sperm banked at the repository. The long-term achievements of most of these children remain unknown, although none, thus far, appears to have won another Nobel Prize. Although Graham's genius bank was ridiculed and eventually disbanded, its early advocacy of germinal choice, that individuals should be free to pick and choose the genetic determinants of their offspring, was hailed by several scientists. A sperm bank of selected genetic geniuses was obviously a crude idea, but selecting genius genes in sperm, on the other hand, was considered a perfectly tenable prospect for the future. But how might sperm or eggs, for that matter, be selected to carry specific enhanced genotypes? Could new genetic material be introduced into the human genome? Although the precise contours of the technology that would enable positive eugenics were yet unknown, several scientists considered this a mere technological hurdle that would be solved in the near future. The geneticist Hermann Muller, evolutionary biologist Ernst Mayr and Julian Huxley, and the population biologist James Crowe were among the vociferous proponents of positive eugenics. Until the birth of eugenics, the only mechanism to select for beneficial human genotypes had been natural selection. Governed by the brutal logic of Malthus and Darwin, the struggle for survival and the slow, tedious emergence of survivors. Natural selection, Crowe wrote, was cruel, blundering, and inefficient. In contrast, artificial genetic selection and manipulation could be based on health, intelligence, or happiness. Support from scientists, intellectuals, writers, and philosophers poured into the movement. Francis Crick staunchly backed neo-eugenics, as did James Watson. James Shannon, director of the National Institutes of Health, told Congress that genetic screening was not just a moral obligation of the medical profession, but a serious social responsibility as well. As eugenics rose in prominence nationally and internationally, its founders tried valiantly to disassociate the new movement from its ugly past, in particular from the Hitlerian overtones of Nazi eugenics. German eugenics had fallen into the abyss of Nazi horrors, neo-eugenicists argued, because of two cardinal errors, its scientific illiteracy and its political illegitimacy. Junk science had been used to prop up a junk state, and the junk state had fostered junk science. Neo-eugenics would sidestep these pitfalls by sticking to two lodestone values, scientific rigor and choice. Scientific rigor would ensure that the perversities of Nazi eugenics would not contaminate neo-eugenics. Genotypes would be evaluated objectively, without interference or mandates from the state, using strict scientific criteria, and choice would be conserved at every step, guaranteeing that eugenic selections, such as prenatal testing and abortion, would occur only with full freedom. Yet, to its critics, eugenics was riddled with some of the same fundamental flaws that had cursed eugenics. The most resonant criticism of neo-eugenics emerged, unsurprisingly, from the very discipline that had breathed life into it, human genetics. As McCusick and his colleagues were discovering with increasing lucidity, the interactions between human genes and illnesses were vastly more complicated than eugenics might have anticipated. Down syndrome and dwarfism offered instructive case studies. For Down syndrome, where the chromosomal abnormality was distinct and easily identifiable, and where the link between the genetic lesion and the medical symptoms was highly predictable, prenatal testing and abortion might seem justifiable. But even with Down syndrome, as with dwarfism, the variation between individual patients carrying the same mutation was striking. Most men and women with Down syndrome experienced deep physical, developmental, and cognitive disabilities, but some, undeniably, were highly functional, leading near independent lives requiring minimal interventions. Even a whole extra chromosome, as significant a genetic lesion as was conceivable in human cells, could not be a singular determinant of disability. It lived in the context of other genes and was modified by environmental inputs and by the genome at large. Genetic illness and genetic wellness were not discrete neighboring countries. Rather, wellness and illness were continuous kingdoms, bounded by thin, often transparent, borders. The situation became even more complex with polygenic illnesses, schizophrenia or autism, say. Although schizophrenia was well known to have a strong genetic component, early studies suggested that multiple genes on multiple chromosomes were intimately involved. How might negative selection exterminate all these independent determinants? And what if some of the gene variants that cause mental disorders in some genetic or environmental contexts were the very variants that produced enhanced ability in other contexts? Ironically, William Shockley, the most prominent donor to Graham's Genius Bank, was himself afflicted by a syndrome of paranoia, aggression, and social withdrawal that several biographers have suggested was a form of high-functioning autism. What if, pouring through Graham's bank in some future era, the selected genius specimens were found to possess the very genes that, in alternative situations, might be identified as